You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
My name is Anthony Richter. I'm Associate Director of the Open Society Institute. I also, in that capacity, oversee the development of our work in Pakistan, which has been an enormous privilege over the past couple of years. And I'm going to moderate this evening's event. I have some words to say, some of a technical and bureaucratic nature, and then I'll introduce our speakers. First, for the technical and bureaucratic, I just want to remind the speakers to do as I'm doing, which is to speak loudly and clearly into the microphone at all time during your presentations, and to invite members of the audience, after the presentations have completed and you would like to speak, there will be microphones where you should pose your questions. That's because I'd like to advise you that the event is being maybe recorded and broadcast on our website subsequently, and so also your presence and participation here means that you may also end up on our website. So I just want to remind you of that, and that's why you need to speak into the mic so that it's audible when you do participate. Finally, I want to indicate the nearest emergency exit. Since we're in emergency rule, we have to have an emergency exit, is this way. Now I'd like to start the event. Much attention over the past month has focused on the emergency rule or martial law, as some have referred to it, and its impact on one profession in particular, and that's the lawyers and the legal profession. Many have seen the events of the past month as an attack on the judiciary, which it has been, however, not less important, not less significant, has been the assault on the media. And somehow, the media, which is responsible for disseminating information about the situation and about its own situation, has somehow received considerably less attention. And at the present time, when news of the end of emergency rule is being advertised, when Musharraf has now removed the military uniform and taken his oath of office as president, as a civilian, there's a sense that things are working themselves out in Pakistan. And I would say, propose that the evening is dedicated to dispelling two misimpressions. First, as I suggested, that the impact of emergency rule has fallen solely on the legal profession, and it's gotten a lot of well-deserved attention for that. What has happened to the media is very significant, and we're going to try to correct the general understanding so that you will leave having seen what tremendous impact emergency rules has taken on the electronic media. And second is to show that the situation is not really working itself out, as one might be led to believe by the dramatic fall-off in coverage in the mainstream media over the past couple of weeks. To assist us in these tasks this evening, we have a very illustrious panel, and I'm going to just introduce them briefly, and this is what, after I present them, we're going to begin the program with a short film. Joining us in Washington, D.C. is Sami Ibrahim, who's the senior correspondent and producer of GOTV in Washington, and as you will hear, GEO has suffered significant setbacks, which are also emblematic of what's happened to television in Pakistan overall. So we're delighted that Sami is joining us. Thank you, and we'll come to you shortly. not yet in the Washington office, will be, but arriving shortly, I'm told, is Ahmed Rashid, the well-known Pakistani journalist with whom we've collaborated on many things in Afghanistan and Central Asia, as well as in Pakistan. And he's visiting Washington now, and he'll also speak with us. In New York, we have Bob Dietz, who's the Asia Program Coordinator, known to many of you here, I noticed, during the pre-talk mingling, who is the Asia Program Coordinator for CPJ, the Committee to Protect Journalists. And finally, we have Kieran Khalid, independent broadcast journalist and host and documentalist. She will be showing a film now entitled We Are Not Free, which is the heading for this evening's proceedings. The film goes for about 15 minutes. I'll ask Kieran to maybe say a word or two about it in advance. Then we will raise the screen, invite the speakers to sit down, and then we'll continue on with the presentations. So, Kieran, if you'd like to come up and say some words, then we'll start your film.
Thank you, Anthony, and thank you to the Open Society Institute and to all of my friends and colleagues that made it out on this cold, snowy night a little bit early. When I embarked on this journey, I had no idea that it would end here with the offenses against journalists in Pakistan being as egregious as they've become. And I had never imagined that I would be on a panel at Columbia that I found myself so ill-suited for, which was addressing lawyers about their future careers. And I happened to look across the panel and see Fawzia Naqvi, who was with OSI, and made a connection that eventually led to this screening here. And as someone who went forward with this project with virtually no funding and no backing, to land here in this forum. Let's show the film.
I'd like to invite the speakers to come up to the table here. We'll raise the screen, and then I see Ahmed Rashid has joined us, and we'll start our presentations. So we've been joined now by Ahmed Rashid as well as Sami Ibrahim. Since Mr. Ibrahim was there first, maybe we'll start with him, and then go to Ahmed Saab. So each of the speakers, we're invited to speak for about 10 minutes, and then we'll continue on, and we'll wrap up with Bob here in New York.
Well, thank you very much, Anthony, but I'll still insist that Ahmed Rashid being so senior. So please, Ahmed, you take the podium and you start.
Well, that's very kind of you. I mean, you know, the developments have moved so fast. I've been out of Pakistan for about 48 hours. But again, there's been another crackdown against the media. I think the real, there are two or three problems. I mean, clearly, the military regime was very rattled by the live broadcast of the protest movement by the lawyers when the Supreme Court Chief Justice was suspended in March, and the movement that followed of civil society, NGOs, women's groups, human rights groups in support of him. The lawyers have been almost on strike since March. The courts have been paralyzed, and all this was very faithfully shown by the media, and I think once the regime decided that they wanted to put an emergency into the country, the media was going to be the first target. Now, since then, unfortunately, we have not seen the kind of international support that was required. Even though, for example, the Bush administration has called for a free and independent media to be restored in Pakistan. At the same time, we have President Bush calling President Musharraf his buddy, and that he's still a reliable partner in the war on terrorism. What we've seen in this crackdown, the crackdown has been aimed basically at civil society. It's been aimed at the media, at lawyers, at the urban middle class, which has been out protesting in the streets. And there doesn't seem to be any kind of crackdown or new crackdown against the extremists, or the madrasa, the extremist groups operating in the tribal areas or anything like that. Now, I think if this has been unprecedented, because even during previous martial laws, Ayub Khan in the 50s, Ziaul Haq in the 70s and 80s, the media was targeted. We should remember Ziaul Haq actually flogged journalists publicly. But it was a very selective targeting. It wasn't that the whole media was shut down. The military selectively targeted people who were critical of martial law at that time. And even this time, it would have been possible, for example, for the regime, horrendous though it may have been, they could have targeted individuals, they could have targeted particular stations that were broadcasting live broadcasts. But there was this complete blanket ban on the media, no holds barred. And I think this has really horrified people in Pakistan. People in Pakistan are now increasingly getting their news from the electronic media in particular, the news channels, and all this has been a major blow to that. We should remember Pakistan is a country where literacy officially is at 54%. Real literacy is probably around 35%. Newspapers are not the main source of news dissemination. The radio was until about 4 or 5 years ago, until these channels came on the air. But now, almost, there are cable operators in the smallest of villages, in the poorest of areas, and the majority of people have been getting their news from these channels. And by shutting these channels down, it's been extremely difficult for people to know actually what's been going on. So I think the whole crackdown has been horrendous, and at the same time, the reason given for this emergency, that is the fight against extremism and terrorism, very little has been done against these extremists, and there has been no new campaign against them. Even now, the kinds of conditions under which some of the channels have come back on air, these conditions have not been made public. We know that the government has insisted upon certain individuals in these in the electronic media being barred from appearing. For example, Talat Hussain, who you just saw, has been very publicly barred from appearing on his channel and running his talk show. Others on Jio have been banned in the same way, and we don't know the conditionalities. And again, the international community has not condemned these conditionalities that some of these channels have been forced to sign in order to come back on air. I think I'll hand over to my colleague.
Yeah, Mr. Ahmed explained everything in a very appropriate way. And if you, the movie we just saw, which was produced by Kiran, it really, if you look at that, it tells what's going on in Pakistan. On the March 9th, President Musharraf, when he decided to remove the Chief Justice, and he did it because that was for the first time during the last 60 years of the country that judiciary was challenging the authority of the armed forces, which enjoyed the complete authority during the last 60 years. Now, when President Musharraf removed the Chief Justice, the media came out, and perhaps, as Mr. Rashid mentioned, and the whole world saw the agitation and the protest which we saw on the streets of Pakistan, some in government believe that it was basically done because the electronic media gave minute-to-minute report and played a very key role. Now, the second time they decided to remove the Chief Justice, but before doing that, they completely put the channels off air, and as they removed the judges from the judiciary they don't like, in the same way they came to the broadcasters, to the owners of the media companies, and they asked them that they don't like certain individuals. So this nexus and this combination of media and judiciary was very unexpected for the military regime. And now they are basically, the pretext is that they have done it because they needed to win the war on terror. But as Mr. Ahmed mentioned, all the state machinery, everything is now basically running behind the moderate political forces, all the lawyers, the journalists, political activists. They have been put behind the bar, but the terrorists, and then we don't see any action against those who are basically coming out and who are supporting all these religious fundamentalists. So I'll stop here and give it to you, Anthony.
Just quickly, one question, because you haven't talked a little bit about GEO and the situation with GEO, your TV station. And I would like to hear what's the latest, because there have been some developments.
Well, the situation at the GEO is that when emergency was imposed, every channel was put off air, and then after a couple of weeks, we received an order from the Dubai Media City and the Geo News, which was the channel of news, was its production was shut down. Geo management tried to negotiate with the DMC, and after a couple of weeks, we got a order and permission from the DMC to start the Geo News. So right now we are uplinking from Dubai Geo News. We have three other channels. One is Geo Sports, the other is ARG, and one is Geo Entertainment. None of the channel is can be watched in Pakistan. Cable operators have been asked to shut down our transmission. And very interestingly, the other three channels, which basically carry sports and the youth programs and entertainment, they have nothing to do with the news. But they were also barred, and especially with the Geo Sports, we suffered about $10 million loss because we had a contract and we had rights to show the cricket series between India and Pakistan. So today we have suffered loss of almost $20 million, and every day we are suffering $300,000 loss. We are being uplinked from Dubai. We can be watched only by those audience and viewers who have the satellite antennas, but we cannot be watched in Pakistan as yet.
Okay, thank you very much. And I have to emphasize how honored and privileged we are to have Ahmed Rashid and Sam Ibrahim joining us. I'd like to pass the floor now to Bob Dietz, who's the Asia Program Director, as I said, at CPJ. And
let's go Kieran first.
Oh, Kieran first is going to add some comments. Great.
Okay. I just want to illuminate for those of you who may not understand the climate of fear that these reporters operate under on a daily basis, because while some of the incidents that you saw in the film do show the brutality in mass, what they go through individually almost daily is something unfathomable to an American journalist. When this story blipped on my radar and I decided to pursue this documentary, I made several phone calls, as most people do, as they're trying to assess what resources are available to them and logistically plan things out. And I was told by people both in Pakistan and people here that if I pursued this story, my life could be in danger. At the very least, I would be followed. My visa could be revoked, meaning I wouldn't be allowed to visit the country of my origin for who knows how long. Those things obviously concerned me, but I pursued it anyway without the assistance of a camera crew. And for those of you who know me in a professional setting, you know I'm a little bit of a news diva. And for me not to have the support of a cameraman on a story like this really illustrates how scared I was, because I went out and bought a camera and posed as a tourist to do my interviews because I did not want to be associated as a member of the media, because I didn't want to become targeted as a member of the media. So when you hear these reporters say things like, we do get phone calls, we are being harassed, they are getting phone calls. And when you have someone who could be ISI, which is Pakistan's equivalent to the CIA, say something like, we're watching you, or watch your back, or we saw your story, those kinds of things are very rattling, especially in a country where you often feel that there is no recourse. Bob?
Thanks, Karen. I thought your piece was wonderful in that it captured what was the seed of the situation we're in now in Pakistan in terms of a media shutdown, and now the media allowed to reappear, but under very stringent conditions. And I frankly had come prepared today to walk through that history, but the film did it much better than I'd be able to. I think the only point that I can add to what's been said so far this evening is that dating the crackdown on the media from the March demonstrations around Chief Justice Chaudhry and his sacking and his reinstatement, I think is a bit misleading. In fact, there's been a fairly steady pressure on the media for quite a long time. Despite the fact that President Musharraf has allowed so many stations to so much electronic media to appear in the public, the Pakistan government under President Musharraf has not been media friendly. We know that we haven't seen this kind of outright shutdown before, but we know that journalists have been constantly under pressure individually, or sometimes their media houses have been under pressure, but it's been more subtle or more under the radar. Since 2001, when the American Wall Street journalist Danny Pearl was killed in Pakistan, 10 journalists have been killed since then, all Pakistani journalists. Unlike Danny, who got a full investigation and a trial, and suspects were brought to trial and sentenced, that hasn't happened for any other Pakistani journalist. The perpetrators, the actors in these journalists' deaths are widely believed by most Pakistani journalists in most of the cases to have been at the hands of the government, not miscreants as put forward. Not all cases clearly are the result of government action, but the disappearances, the deaths, the detentions have been a constant reality for Pakistani journalists in the years before this. And what we see now is a broadening of that policy, I think, which was ineffective in terms of silencing the media, in which President Musharraf took on larger business interests, broadcast interests, tried to hit them economically, and the result we see now is this crackdown. Still going against Dawn, the Dawn Group, and Geo, we were in touch with the broadcasters and the publishers. Well before Supreme Court Justice Chaudhry's incident in March, and they were already under pressure. The government had withdrawn advertising support in the newspapers, had tried to withdraw Geo's cable license, and we saw this as a foreshadowing of what we're seeing now, of just trying to shut down these businesses, the businesses that President Musharraf allowed to blossom, to pull the rug out from under them economically. So when it didn't work, when the tactic of killing or disappearing journalists or seizing them and holding them, releasing them after 6 months, when that didn't work, I think as the political situation in Pakistan evolved this year, I think President Musharraf knew that he would have to take on larger tactics. But in fact, what we're seeing now is an extension of what has been going on for several years before these incidents that have us so concerned now. And I'd like to cut my remarks short and turn them over to my Pakistani colleagues, who have, I'm sure, a lot more to say.
Thank you very much. And I just want to thank again Karen. She didn't say that this is the first time that her film, which she's just made, has been shown, and so we're very honored that she chose this occasion for it to be aired for the first time. I wanted to ask you, Karen, what you're hearing in terms of any signs that a lifting of this media crackdown will take place in advance of the promised elections or in connection with the lifting of emergency rule?
Well, I think my colleague in D.C. might be better suited to elaborate on my answer, but basically, the media and reporters who have been allowed to continue operating within the country are doing so after signing basically a PEMRA ordinance, am I right, Bob, that basically bars them from reporting anything against the state, the military, members of the parliament who are aligned with Musharraf. And on September 11th, 2007, this year, Musharraf actually, before he declared this so-called emergency, had actually issued, or through PEMRA, had issued yet another ordinance that said that no Pakistani journalists could write or say anything against any country allied with Pakistan. So you can imagine what little freedom you have for maneuvering when so many restrictions have been placed on you. And this is out of order a little bit, but I just want, if I could just acknowledge my editor who's here. Marcus, could you just stand up? Marcus edited the film that you guys saw tonight. And also I have Sonia Chada, who's here. Sonia, could you stand up? Sonia is the associate producer who did the initial research on the film, and her Googling efforts are remarkable because those notes were my map when I went to Pakistan, and I was able to track down the journalist who eventually helped me form my story through the information that she gave me. But I want to turn it over to my colleague in D.C. so you can elaborate a little bit, Mr. Abraham, about the restrictions under which the journalists are currently operating.
Well, Jio Television has not basically surrendered to the code of conduct, so-called code of conduct, which has been put up by PEMRA. But the channels who have signed or reached an agreement with the government, first of all, they have blocked certain programs. And then on certain issues, like for instance, about the Army of Pakistan, about the person of President of Pakistan, and then also about certain actions of the government, they cannot say anything. That's why they have blocked the talk shows. In the news item, we don't, in the news bulletins, we don't deal with these things. And interestingly, Jio went to the superior court in the province of Sindh, and our petition was rejected. It was declared unmaintainable by the Sindh High Court, saying that under the emergency rule, they cannot give any relief to the media organization. Though we had not challenged the emergency rule, we had simply requested that Jio Sports, Jio Entertainment, and the other channel for the youth has nothing to do with the news. Please permit them. The government over there simply said that we have not banned any channel. It was the Jio's transmission which was suspended by the Dubai government. So the journalists, they are working under very strict conditions, but what we are hearing now, that there is a code of conduct being developed by the PBA, which is a Broadcasters Association, and they are going to hold a meeting within the next few days to talk with the government on that issue.
Ahmed, yes, please.
Can I just make add a few things? I mean, one of the things, for example, we know that they have banned the government is any live press conferences. No electronic media is allowed to cover live press conferences by any opposition leader, Benazir Bhutto, Nawaz Sharif, or anyone else. Secondly, there is a list of people who are not allowed to appear on talk shows. That is people from the opposition, dissidents, human rights groups, etc. People who be critical of the government are just not allowed to be summoned and to come on to talk shows. Quite apart from the fact that some of the best talk shows in the country have actually been taken off air. Secondly, I just wanted to add to what Bob said, when I think, you know, he made a very important point here, that actually the Pakistan media has been struggling for the last 2 or 3 years because of highly restrictive deals. More than about a quarter of the country has been off limits to journalists for the last 2 years. For example, Baluchistan province, where there's been an insurgency, where one of the leading Baloch dissidents, Nawab Akbar Bukti, was killed last year. In Balochistan, journalists are not really able, they're far too scared to report. And newspaper editors, for example, and even some of the electronic media have been very hesitant to carry any reports about Balochistan. And in fact, earlier this year, the government banned the advertisements, the government advertisements for Dawn, one of the major English newspapers, because it insisted on continuing to cover the insurgency in Balochistan. Dawn is the largest selling newspaper in Balochistan province. Secondly, journalists have been barred from covering the tribal areas where the Taliban insurgency is taking place, where the Pakistani Taliban and Al-Qaeda are very active, and a number of journalists, which CPJ have written about in great detail, were killed, in fact, in the tribal areas. And there's a large, now, of course, there's an insurgency in Swat, in the valley of Swat, where the Taliban are also active, and there too, journalists are not being allowed to cover it at all. Secondly, I just want to talk very briefly about the print media. The print media is also under enormous pressure. It has not been banned, but it is under a restriction. It's being watched very closely. Phone calls are coming every evening to the news desk as to what they should run on the front page, what they can't run on the front page, what should be above the flap, and what should be below the flap, what photographs can be run and what photographs can't be run. And there's an enormous amount of self-censorship by the print media, and the owners of the print media, and even by journalists writing for the print media at the moment.
Let me add one point, Anthony, here. As Bob mentioned, the pressure on the media, even before this emergency was announced, the government approached all the business entrepreneurs. And the Jio Television was one day they got telephone calls from all the big players of telecom industry, the telephone companies, and they said that they want their ads off the air within the next 2 hours. And Jio even offered to keep on running the ads without even charging them money, but they said no. We are under enormous pressure, and we want these ads to be stopped. So the government this time is coming out with a different tactics. Not only that they blocked the government ads, but they were also pressurizing the other businesses not to give the ads. And to talk about the misery of the journalists, there is a new tactic introduced by the government and by the other pressure groups. Not only the journalists, but now the family members of the journalists are being attacked and being targeted. There are certain cases, I would quote here the incident of the wife of Hayatullah. She was killed, and then another journalist of BBC, his son was killed, then his brother was killed. So sometimes they don't attack the journalists directly, but the family members have to pay the price.
Anthony, if I could just add on the heels of their comments, in terms of what's happening in Swat Valley, where it is the Taliban stronghold, those aren't the only people there. Obviously, not everyone who lives in that region supports the Taliban. They live in terror. And because of this media crackdown, they are not getting the information about the military insurgency into their backyard. So you have people who are further traumatized by the fact that their own military is coming in and rumors run rampant. So they don't know what's going on. Furthermore, a lot of the Pakistan government relied on the media for their information as well. So now you have a disjointed government where people aren't getting accurate information. I've been in close contact with Talat Hussain, and shortly after the emergency, he told me you would go into government offices and you would see CNN or you would see Jio or Aaj or one of the Pakistani stations on, and they would have their crawl with their information. Those televisions are off. They're not relying on PTV for their information either.
I just wanted to thank you, Karen, and our speakers in Washington. I just wanted to add, we had advertised that we were hoping to have Talat Hussain participate, and he had indicated that he would try to be available. Mind you, it's about 5 in the morning now in Pakistan. We were unable to reach him. Unfortunately, we had him on tape in Karen's film. I wanted to to ask, though, what, I mean, you made a very good point just now about the fact that the government is not getting feedback by having an active free media, but also because of the restrictions that our speakers have referred to about showing people in the opposition and certain speakers. To what extent is this affecting the kind of popular reaction to the crackdown, the absence of mass demonstrations and the like?
Let's take it from Washington.
Yeah, let's.
Frankly, these are guys who are on the ground and running in and out of there all the time.
I agree that there were no mass protest demonstrations in Pakistan. But if you look at the type of the crackdown, and if you look at the images, so you can imagine that how brutal the government was. But despite all the government tactics, what we are seeing for the last few days, there is a mobilization at the students' level. And the students of the colleges and universities, they are coming. And what is the point of protest right now? The points are the offices of the GOTV in Lahore, in Karachi, and in Islamabad. Students in hundreds, they are coming over there, and they are participating in the protest demonstrations. And now they have announced to take out a bus from the judicial, from the judges' colony. That bus will travel all across the Pakistan, and perhaps it will also mobilize. I do agree that there were no mass demonstrations, but Pakistanis in majority, they rejected all the emergency rule, they rejected the actions of the president and the present regime. They want a free media, and they have shown, they have said that in various surveys, and now this this movement is being mobilized at the students level and also at the factory and workers and laborers level.
And it's being mobilized in a very ingenious way. Students are using Facebook to contact each other in Pakistan and around the world to mobilize these demonstrations. In addition to that, they're having flash demonstrations where people rally literally for 10 to 15 minutes with signs with a lot of fervor, just long enough for the police sirens to be heard, and then they scatter. So they've made their point, they've made their presence without being beaten or hauled away by the police.
I would agree with the Karen, because yesterday there was a demonstration in the city of Islamabad, and students were barred by the police, and they were not allowed to move in form of a demonstration. So they went there in the groups of three or four, and they assembled in front of the press club, and then they took out a big protest procession. So yeah, students are very innovative, and they're finding new techniques to come out on the streets and do that protest.
Amit, would you like to add anything to that at this time?
Well, you know, I just want to make a point that some of you have already made, but I think it's very important to understand the fact that this crackdown has now also involved a foreign country, in other words, Dubai.
Yeah.
The fact that the government in Dubai, the authorities in Dubai were persuaded to, you know, stop Jio from broadcasting internationally, which is what the facility in Dubai was providing. The fact that, you know, the government of Dubai was involved, I think, is a real indicator to how far the regime is willing to go in order to make life very difficult for the media. As far as these demonstrations are concerned, I think, you know, what we've seen is basically the urban educated, urban middle class in of all sectors, professions, NGOs, media, human rights, women's groups, lawyers, of course, journalists, all these elements coming out. And I think, again, this is the first time in Pakistan that the urban elite, as it were, has taken on such a responsibility. So I think it's very significant. And it's very significant, I think, in the Muslim world in general. I mean, this is the first time in my memory that in one of the largest Muslim countries in the world, that the middle class should come out in such a way in protest against a regime.
Indeed, a friend of mine from Egypt wrote me and said they were so sorry for what was happening in Pakistan, but also secretly a little envious that at least something was moving. You know, there was some activity. When you said, Amit, that a foreign country has been involved in the internal dealings in Pakistan, I thought you were about to mention the country in whose capital you're sitting. And I was wondering if the speakers would like to talk a little bit about how you would appraise Washington's reaction to what's been happening in Pakistan in general, and particularly on the subject of the media.
You know, I must say here that, I mean, I think there are three red lines that the military has drawn which they're not going to cross. I mean, the first is, without a doubt, that the military is not going to restore a free and independent judiciary. The government is not going to restore, the government is not going to restore a free and independent judiciary. The government is not going to restore, in the old way, a free and independent media. It's going to control it. And thirdly, I think the government is all set to rig the elections. Now, in all these three red lines that have been drawn by the government, I think what we're seeing is that the Americans have basically acquiesced to them. Yes, they're calling for a free and independent judiciary, but they're not asking for the restoration of the ousted judiciary. Yes, they're calling for a free and independent media, but they're not questioning the kind of conditionalities that have been put down by the government for the media to come back on air, or, for example, the kind of pressures that are on the print media. And there are no really specific... Yes, the American government is calling for free and fair elections, but again, there are no specifics by the government to expose the kind of manipulation that is being done by Islamabad. So I think, you know, in all these three red lines, what we are going to see in the days and weeks ahead is that the American government is going to acquiesce to them. And I think that is really tragic, because clearly the U.S. sets the pace as far as the West is concerned. We haven't seen much of a reaction from European governments, unfortunately. The European governments are also looking towards Washington as to what is going to happen here, and what kind of reaction is going to come from here. And I think, you know, apart from Pakistan, I mean, I stress this. I mean, what is being lost is the whole struggle against extremism in the wider Muslim world. If this is the way the U.S. government is going to promote democracy in the Muslim world, freedom of expression and independent judiciary, etc., then frankly, you know, I mean, other Muslim authoritarian regimes are going to be extremely happy, and other civil society groups in Muslim countries are going to be very reluctant to come out. And all of this is going to be very helpful to extremism and terrorism.
And I would simply add that perhaps it was a wonderful opportunity for the government of the United States to win heart and minds of the people of Pakistan by coming out with the statements and supporting the lawyers and the journalists. Rather than doing that, they came out, as Mr. Rashid mentioned, that whatever they have done probably is a lost opportunity for the Washington to win hearts and minds of the people of Pakistan.
Just one point, and I think you've hit all those points well, and I think it's easy to draw parallels between what American journalists are seeing and a sort of circumvention of the judiciary at times in the name of fighting extremism and terrorism. The failure at times of the media in the U.S. to confront those issues, and we haven't rigged elections here yet, but you know. Mm-hmm. But one thing, and I have
getting
to
harder and harder.
Right,
with the straight face.
One thing I have to, the person I have to stick up for, and this doesn't come easily or readily to me, just because I'm from the U.S. But Ambassador Ann Patterson has gone out of her way, I think, to sort of do whatever's reasonable for an ambassador to do in the face of what's coming from the State Department and what's coming from the White House. I think she is constantly, at least when it comes to the media particularly, constantly addressing these issues and trying to get some change in direction, especially on the media issues. Having said that, I don't want to be seen as someone sitting here waving an American flag, and I think the message is coming out of Washington.
I agree with you, Bob. I think she's played a great role, and it's being very much appreciated by Pakistanis at all levels and the media. And you know, clearly she's running at odds with what the official line is from the State Department and from the White House. And I think she is taking, she's being very bold and very courageous. And probably is taking a risk with what the official line is. But I must say, her efforts have been appreciated. I mean, you know, she visited Jio, she visited these other channels, she tried to visit, for example, Ehtedal Ehsan, the leading lawyer in Pakistan who's defending the Supreme Court. She wasn't allowed to visit him. She's been to visit Asma Jahangir, the head of the Human Rights Commission in Pakistan. She has been, she's gone out of her way to highlight, to highlight the opposition to what Musharraf has done. And I think also in a way, by highlighting that, she's also trying to wake up Washington. To show Washington what perhaps its policy should be.
Point made.
I'd like to open the floor here in New York to members of the audience, and I just ask you, in posing your question, to approach the microphone and then to state your name for the benefit of the speakers.
My name is Peter Irwin. I was wondering, given the high illiteracy rate in Pakistan, and that many of the people may, as you've suggested, be influenced by the media, and given that many people are also being influenced by the fundamentalists, and given concerns conceivably of the army, that if the media is free to independently report on what's going on, perhaps it would be more difficult for the army to control the extremists. What was the justification, or what have you found to be the impact of the media in the rural areas, in the areas where there is illiteracy, and to what extent can you either confirm or invalidate the concerns that the government apparently is having?
Thank you. We'll continue to take a couple of questions at a time in order to keep things flowing. Sir.
Okay. Well, first of all, I welcome Mr. Ahmed Rashid. I saw him last time in the Luya Jirga in Afghanistan. Good to see you, sir. And Kiran, congratulations on that great documentary. My question is to Mr. Ahmed
Rashid. Please just introduce your good self.
Okay. My name is Majid Babar, and I'm a Pakistani journalist now in exile due to the problem going on in Pakistan. My question from Ahmed Rashid is, the Pakistani media is irresponsible to covering the war on terror, or they are too much, you know, like creating the fuss against the present government. Is it that true that the Pakistani government is making point that they are very irresponsible? Thank you.
Okay, we can. Why don't we take one more questioner here, and then we'll go around our speakers.
Hi, I'm Janet Larson. I'm a professor at Rutgers University in New Jersey and a freelance journalist from time to time, and a great admirer of Mr. Rashid's work. I'd like to ask. Both of them, I guess, what effect this emergency rule and what other things going on, particularly the journalists, is going to be having on Afghanistan? Could you predict or tell us what's happening? That's my question.
Okay, thank you. Who would like to start?
I give it over to these boys.
Yeah, okay. I'm actually very interested in knowing, too, what your reaction is as Pakistani journalists about the accusations that the media in Pakistan is run amok, that they are sensationalist and basically responsible for creating discord in the country where there otherwise would not be any.
Well, listen, I mean, certainly, you know, there have been excesses, there's no doubt. I mean, we should remember that the electronic media is 4 or 5 years old. Most of the people working in the electronic media are actually from the print media. And certainly in certain, you know, bombings and suicide attacks, etc., there have been the showing of bodies and, you know, things which would not appear if there had been perhaps more rigorous editing. Now, it's a whole chain of command. It's not just that the cameraman is taking, you know, bloody pictures, but there's a whole chain of command in that channel. And clearly, there is room for improvement on that score. There's also the accusation that there has been perhaps excessive militancy being espoused by people who are coming on to talk shows. Fiery mullahs, fiery politicians who support Osama bin Laden and things like that. But really, I think I don't think this has been irresponsible. I don't think it's been excessive. I think it is, it's part of the growing up pains of having a very new media, having inexperienced journalists working with an electronic media, not perhaps realizing the impact of what they're doing. It hasn't been enormous. It's been quite little, I think, given the circumstances. And I think this has basically been an excuse by the government to slam the media. On Afghanistan, I mean, you know, there has been a press crackdown underway in Afghanistan over the last 1 year, in fact. The press has been faced with, there too, the TV channels have been faced with problems by President Karzai as well as by Parliament. They have had their own problems. Again, I think, you know, CPJ has played a very important role in highlighting that. I fear very much that, again, in the Muslim world, if, you know, a country like Pakistan, with a highly developed middle class, with a highly developed media, with long traditions of media struggle and media freedom, if other rulers and other regimes in the Muslim world see this happening in Pakistan, they are more than likely to emulate it and to copy it.
To the point of this question of Mr. Barber about media being irresponsible, I would simply say that whenever you talk about media, there are two components of the media. One are the news bulletins and others are the talk shows. We have not seen any investigative story coming out of Pakistani media during the last 5 years, which could have put any important thing in jeopardy as far as President Musharraf is concerned or war on terror is concerned. Yes, on the talk shows, there were sometimes excesses, but these were because the people on the side of the government were unable to defend their point of view. So if they were unable to defend their point of view, you cannot blame media for that. I would simply stick to that.
I think the third question was about...
The rural response, yeah? Would you like to reframe it?
Well, you know, illiteracy in Pakistan is everywhere. It's not confined to the rural areas, unfortunately. So for the illiterate population within the urban centers, electronic media is very powerful because they are able to see and hear what they cannot read. As far as the fringe areas or the NWFP, the areas where journalists find it simply too dangerous for them to work, I think by muzzling the media at the urban level, you're never going to have the expansion you need into those areas to inform those people who currently don't have access, and clearly they're not going on the internet if they don't have electricity. But I encourage my colleagues in D.C. to weigh in if they can illuminate that further.
You said it very well.
Thank you.
Very good.
Just 2 points.
Yes, please go ahead.
One, Afghanistan. There is an accelerating crackdown on media in the country, and I think it's mainly aimed at broadcast, as it is in Afghanistan, and I think it's because of the images transmitted over television are are more likely to transcend, particularly in a country like Afghanistan, sort of sensibilities that the government has a hard time dealing with. But there's also a political component to that as well. I know Lamar TV, which is operated by Tolo TV, which is a larger group of broadcasters in Kabul and throughout Afghanistan, was just told yesterday that they're no longer allowed to retransmit Al Jazeera TV, which the Afghan government takes issue with frequently in the way that Afghanistan is portrayed. And I think in Afghanistan you have to see the two issues are at work. One, that a very devout Muslim society is having a hard time coping with seeing young women doing video DJ shows and those sort of things, and it's a real stretch for the government to try and handle that. On the other part is that, in fact, the government's uncomfortable with a lot of the news and criticism which is being transmitted over the air, which again reaches a largely even more illiterate society than Pakistan. And there's one other point that I'd like to make. That was a cameraman in Beirut in 1982 and 1983 when the Israelis invaded. And I worked for a syndication service. It's now called Reuters TV and was called Vis News at the time. And I was fairly enraged by everything I saw going on in front of my eyes for 18 months. And I was a cameraman who took a lot of pictures of body parts, of arms and hands and heads and dismembered children and blood in the streets and the stains and all that gore. And we also took the weeping widow shots, and we took the fighting men shots and the diving F-16 shots. And there's a whole range of visual imagery that comes out of a camera at any in any situation. That's passed up the line, and it goes to editors, it goes to senior editors, it goes through distributors. It's censored, it's filtered all along the line. I was told that the really brutal imagery, which I was picking up in Lebanon at that time, was very often used on Arab TV stations. There's pretty obviously anti-Israeli and played very well, and people weren't afraid of using those dismembered bodies and those real horror pictures, and the softer stuff, the weeping widows and the valiant fighting men, were what made it to Western stations. Those are editorial decisions that made up and down the line. To shut down a television station for showing an offensive picture is illegitimate. It's wrong. There are standards. Audiences expect these things. Audiences know what they want, and they will turn off, turn away, not use that imagery, not put it into their moral calculus as it goes by on air. The government might be offended by these pictures. Viewers might be offended by, really sickening imagery. I think over time what happens is that each culture, each society, picks the images that it wants to use, puts them to use, and forms its worldview that way. As Achim and Sammy said, electronic media, these industries, these very competitive television stations, by the way, are 5 years old. But they are run by senior journalists, people in, I know most of the people on editorial positions in the newsrooms and the broadcast newsrooms do have a sensibility. And I think they are coming to grips with how to use these pictures. And I agree with Ahmed that there were some excesses and most likely I don't think the government was angered by the excesses of an arm laying in the street. I think they were angered by the implications of an arm laying in the street, sort of saying, the government is not protecting you. There are things, terrible things happening in our country. What can we do to deal with those? I think I've rattled on long enough, but understand that the selection of those pictures is the end result of a lot of people thinking about them, everyone from the cameraman on the ground and actually to the bomber or the person who perpetrates the act in the first place, up to the person who takes the picture, up to the person who edits the picture, up to the person who says, this goes on the air or doesn't. And I think that's a maturing process that's going on in Pakistan. And I think that country will have to sort it out on its own. But I don't think the government's upset just by ugly pictures. I think it's upset by the implications of those pictures rather than the pictures themselves.
Well, I think the government...
I'm sorry. I just want to say one thing, which is that Ahmed had very kindly agreed to participate in the forum this evening, and I know that he may be under time pressure, and I don't want him to feel that he can't leave to meet his other obligations without our thanking him. Ahmed, do you have to leave now?
Yeah, I have to. I'm sorry about that.
But this was by previous arrangement, and we're just so honored that you took time out from a very busy schedule in Washington for this evening's discussion. We're going to continue on, if you'll allow us, without you.
Thank you very much indeed. Great pleasure to be with you. Okay. A wonderful connection.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ahmed-san.
I just wanted to add, in terms of what Bob was saying, I think that to call the Pakistani government hypocritical at this point is an understatement. But for them to argue that the media is inflaming tensions with their imagery is ironic when you consider the fact that some of the most jarring imagery has been the Pakistani military and police ransacking studios during live broadcasts.
I'd like, before we get our, we have another three speakers here. I just want to, I can't remind you because I didn't say it initially, but if you have a cell phone, if you do the courtesy of putting it on silent. Now our three, we have three more questioners here.
Hi, Abed Imam, Pillsbury, Winthrop, Shopitman. I just had a question. I wanted Ahmed Rashid to answer part of it. So, I leave it to the rest of you. So, I missed your documentary, which I regret. I was stuck at work. But what can one do next? What sort of hope is there once the elections happen? The elections could be partially free and fair. It's very likely that they will be rigged. What is going to happen? Do we just sort of accept the fact that the media is going to be restricted and more so? Will Jio put up a fight? Is it going to compromise at some point when its revenues, when the loss is $30 million? When it's 50, what is, you know, where do you cap it? Is Jio thinking of maybe relocating to another country outside of the United Arab Emirates so it's still available online and via satellite at the very least? It's a very depressing state of affairs, and I just wanted looking for some hope. Awesome.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Jacqueline Brown, and I guess my question is a bit more of a follow-up on his, in that I'm wondering if you could speak a bit more about the effects of media and the current state of media in Pakistan on potential elections, and if you think that it's necessary to liberalize and improve the state of the media first before these elections are held, or if you think that elections will instigate change and improvement. Thank you.
Thank you. Sir, did you have a question?
I happen to be one of your uninvited guests over here because someone who works closely with the Open Society Institute invited me, my friend Bobby Khan. I happen to be a journalist from the United Nations.
Please, sir, just identify yourself.
My name
we're
is
very, Hi- very, it's an open
My name
forum.
Is Haizar Rizvi.
You're welcome. You're most welcome.
I write for OneWorld.net, Interpress Service, and Pacifica Radio.
Thank you. Thank you for coming.
And the question is, I'm curious to know why the Open Society Institute is interested in organizing this gathering about a country called Pakistan, a land where I was born and raised. Why?
Okay, I guess that one's for me. but in all seriousness, we have the two other questions first, and we have the other three speakers, and we'll them in turn.
You know, these elections are a Pakistani issue, and I stand down from them. You know, I only that as it stands right now, I don't think there's going to be very good media coverage of elections in Pakistan. But those implications, I think Pakistanis have to answer.
Yeah, I'm going to let Sammy answer that, but just wanted to point out, which may be obvious, is the fact that you can't really have free and fair elections unless information about the candidates is readily available. And under the current media climate or the conditions that they're constraints rather that they're working under, I don't know how they'd be able to give anyone equal time, much less cover the elections. Sammy?
Yeah, well, it's not possible to have free and fair elections under the present circumstances, because on the one hand, government has put ban all the big meetings and the rallies, saying that they have fear of suicidal bombing, and on the other hand, no live coverage is allowed, no broadcast media is allowed. So perhaps it was designed to rig the elections and to get the people of choice elected. And coming to the other point which the gentleman asked about the GOTV, he asked a very valid question, that how long GO management will be able to sustain with this loss. We are already behind in salaries, but until today, up till now, all the workers, all the journalists are united, and they're fighting. And despite the efforts of government of Pakistan, they have not been able to create any divides among the ranks of the working journalists. But on the other hand, we see the media owners. Yes, government was able to create some divide, and except you, all other channels, they are working with a different conditionalities, and we don't blame them, because it is these are business entrepreneurs, and some people, some business organizations, they don't have that much financial power to sustain the loss, so probably they opted the other way. But I would say here, Ahmed Rashid mentioned earlier, and he said it very rightly, that this is the time we need international support. This is a time that all the civilized world should come and speak and put President and ask President Musharraf to reverse all those actions. And lastly, my friend Heather did not ask question to me, but I would say that Open Society has picked up the topic of Pakistan, and I'm really glad as a Pakistani American. And I'm much thankful that Pakistani, perhaps at this time, needs that support, needs the people from the civilized world to come and support and put President Musharraf pressure to reverse all his actions.
Thank you, Mr. Ibrahim. And I'm very happy that you asked a question about why we're doing it. I think it's probably to most of us self-evident that the country is in a very dire situation, and we've been engaged there for the past several years as the country has been involved trying to progress in a number of different sectors. And we've been working in the sphere of education, trying to support the development of quality education in the public schools, which are very much in need of that. Our engagement in that sector led us to forge very strong friendships, and when the tragic earthquake struck 2 years ago, we became involved in the humanitarian response to that. Finally, in terms of combating poverty, we've been engaged with trying to provide financial services to the underbanked with my good colleague here, Fawzia Naqvi, at the Soros Economic Development Fund. We've been very public and very committed in our friendships. And when something like this happens to our friends and they call upon us to provide a forum, we're most happy to do so. So the forum continues. If we have some more questions from the audience, you're most welcome. Yeah, just come to the microphone to ask your question so that it can be.
My question
I think
he just responded to
I
your question, sir.
I think I just responded. So,
do you want to answer his question before?
No, no, no. I've answered it, and Mr. Ibrahim has answered it, and so I think we can continue.
Great. My name is Tanya Kokar. I'm from Karachi, and my question is: the role of the radio. How suppressed is the radio, and how are people coming forward and talking about these ideas over the radio? I believe a lot of people, the poor people especially, they do listen to it. It's a very important tool. And one of my friends, he works on the radio station, and he plays music. And when this was happening, he was playing these revolutionary songs. He was playing Bob Marley, and like basically spreading these ideas through music, which is really, really incredible. Which would really collect the youth, especially in terms of spreading these ideas. But my question is, what is the radio doing to spread any awareness, or is Musharraf and the government, are they suppressing this as well?
The two major news radio stations, Power 105 and Mast, I've forgotten the other two, are both still off air. Yeah, they're two FM stations, which had far, they weren't just limited to Islam, but they ranged throughout a lot of the country, are both still off air, completely shut down. You can accuse them of showing body parts. I think it's clear that this sort of interactive media, like radio and call-in programs and news and radio can actually cover news more aggressively than television a lot of times and reaches a lot more people, presents a real threat to the government. And the reason these are shut down is because they present a threat to the government, that their critical coverage can't be tolerated under by this government at this point.
And let me add to what Bob just said, that the government banned those two powerful channels which were spreading the news. But very interestingly, there are about 70 radio channels which are working in the district of Sawad, mm-hmm. Which is under military operation. And government hasn't shut down those FM channels which were being run by the militants. And they're still on, and the government says that they are technologically unable to do that, and it's very surprising that those FM channels are still on air and they are working.
Most of those FM channels were pirate radio stations, and if you're a student of media, I think you really have to look at the role that radio plays in countries like Pakistan, and not just Pakistan, but throughout most of the developing world, that they have a very far-reaching effect. They again are more interactive. They can be localized. They're very cheap to run, and they have a great impact. And I forget who was asking a question about Afghanistan, but yes, one of the major targets of conservative religious groups are low-powered FM stations that were set up across the country by a group called Internews and independently, which have proven to be very effective, given voices to women, reach households. Women who aren't allowed to appear on the street can call in on cell phones and have their voices heard on radio, which is just maddening to people who want to silence media. They bomb them, they smash them, they blow them up, they burn them down. In Afghanistan, not terribly difficult to do. There's small buildings with a very small antenna, the same way that you could bomb someone's house, you can take out a radio station very, very easily. The adaptive part about this is that they can be replaced for a few thousand dollars. They're not a major investment like a television station. But the reality is that once something's blown up like that, you're going to find very few people ready to invest not their time or their money, but their safety or security. For Internews, for the radio stations, we're off on a tangent here. I hope you don't mind. In Afghanistan, Internews set up stations, ideally hoping, wanting them to become self-supporting with local advertising. In small villages, you'd have a well driller advertising on the local radio station. And throughout Afghanistan, a lot of the mobile phone companies present offer a lot of advertising revenue. But by and large, they're still supported by, they're still subsidized and Internews, which receives a lot of U.S. aid money, by the way, is really committed to keeping them alive. But that's a real tangent. Sorry.
Okay.
Hi. Again, my name is Majid Baba. I'm a Pakistani, and I'm thankful of Open Society and Mr. Anthony that you are doing that. You take up on the free media, and we are, you know, we are hoping that you will do it with the next. You know, events that to bring more Pakistani American or other people concerned with the Pakistani situation now, and I'm really thankful of. My question is from Karen: what you gonna do with this documentary? Are you gonna take it somewhere, sell it, and you know? And at the same time, you know, can you tell us a brief story about what's happened when you were in Pakistan, how you did it, how you got it, and a brief story of that? Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. A question that allows me to be self-indulgent. The documentary is for sale. See me after the screening if you're interested. Actually, was I had an offer, but it was embarrassingly low, so still on the market. As far as what I did when I was in Pakistan, as I mentioned earlier, I was I shot it on my own. Tracked down the journalists who CPJ and Human Rights Watch had documented as being harassed. You, Majid, were instrumental in getting me some phone numbers so that I could track some of those people down. And once I started talking to them, initially I was afraid for my own safety, not knowing if I was being followed, whether my tapes would be confiscated at the airport or before then. So I started shooting wedding footage and family footage on each tape so that I could cue it up to that and when I went through customs. But after I spoke to, the first person I interviewed was the one who's been called everything under the sun, Ahmed Qureshi, who's the PTV anchor who appears in the piece. And after interviewing him, I was a little bit rattled. I thought, do I have a story? Because he was so adamant that I did not have a story. And then I interviewed a couple of other reporters, including Iman, the vibrant young woman who jumps out off the screen at you. And I thought, if these people are brave enough to go on the record with their stories of harassment or the dangerous conditions that they work under, then certainly I, as an American journalist with a U.S. passport and, you know, the refuge of the embassy should I need it, I can certainly pretend to make a home movie of them and edit something together when I come back. And I came back, and Telus Hussein was instrumental in giving me the footage that I needed free of charge, which is a really big deal, so that I could incorporate it into the film and really illustrate a lot of the brutality that the broadcast journalists there faced.
Some more questions? Okay.
Just a clarification, Anthony, when I asked about why Open Society chose this event, and why did you invite all these people over here, that was a genuine question.
I provided you a genuine answer.
But why? I'm a sympathetic journalist.
I don't really have much to add.
Okay, it's all right.
To my initial response.
Before we all leave, another question. I didn't hear anything in this gathering about the connection between Washington and Islamabad. I haven't heard much about the Bush administration, what it's doing, and what is its relationship with the Pakistani military regime. Former Ambassador John Negroponte, he was in Islamabad. He didn't meet Benazir Bhutto. He met General Musharraf, President Musharraf, they would say. So if we are talking about Pakistan, we must really talk a lot about the relationship between Washington and Islamabad in the past 40 years, 50 years. I'm sorry, I'm not asking a question this time. I never ask, as a journalist, I always ask questions briefly. This is the first time in my whole life as a journalist that I started commenting. But I had the feeling that the people over here, they are concerned about the future of humanity. That's why they are here. That's why the Committee to Protect Journalists, this great filmmaker, and Open Society Institute. I know. The relationship between Washington and Islamabad.
Thank you.
And the relationship between Washington and New Delhi. None of us talked about it. Yeah. If we want to know.
Actually, we did.
I stop in a minute.
I think we have quite enough of the question now on the basis of which to respond.
So, George W. Bush administration and Pakistani military, we must all think about this relationship.
Thank you.
Gone wrong.
Thank you. I do believe we gave the question once to Washington, to our friends in Washington earlier in the program. If anyone feels the wish to respond additionally, we can do
so. Yeah, I do.
Bob?
Yeah. There's some great implied criticism in those questions, and I think we could sort them out. And you recognize the emotionality of that resentment, and I think there's a great deal of legitimacy there. I think Pakistan's a creation of responsibility of Pakistanis, but I think over the years, policies towards Pakistan and acceptance of the things that have gone wrong in Pakistan by people in Washington has been ostensibly served Washington's or the United States' interest. The resentment that I think we just heard, the anger, I don't think is misplaced. I think it's legitimate. In the end, I think Pakistan is a responsibility of Pakistanis. To the extent that the United States has played a role in that, it's a responsibility of Americans. Mazhar Abbas, who you saw in the movie, was an award winner for CPJ this year. We give an award to brave journalists, and Mazhar is, you know, is head of the Pakistan Federal Union of Journalists. And I wound up spending a lot of time with him, and he'd been a real go-to guy for me for the last 2 years, and I just hold him in the highest esteem. And he pointed out that his greatest frustration was that Pakistan seen as a haven for terrorists. When he pointed out, every time Pakistanis have had an election, they voted almost overwhelmingly, or very, very, very largely, in favor of pro-democratic parties. Certainly flawed parties with ties to old regimes or feudal families, but they've made democratic decisions. And 5 times in the last 50 years, 60 years, those governments have been overthrown by military leaders. And and those
regime was backed by Washington.
I'll leave it go with that. But you can hear that that resentment and that emotionality and that fervor, I don't think, is misplaced. And let's just end it at that. Okay.
Anthony, just let me add one point here. That was for the first time in the history of Pakistan that any army chief who was president, he left the office of the army chief of staff. And we must acknowledge that it would have never happened if Washington had not put pressure on President Musharraf to do that. But unfortunately, it has not been played out properly. Yes, the people expect more and more from Washington, D.C., because being a major player, Washington, D.C. can play a bigger role. But at the same time, we must acknowledge whatever is being done. And perhaps this is for the first time that Washington put a pressure on Islamabad and President Musharraf. He had to give up the office of the Army Chief of Staff. We must not forget that.
Okay. Maybe we'll just, we have a one more, or two more questioners, and then we're kind of drawing to the end of our time for this evening.
My name is Arlene Chang, and I'm from India. I was just wondering, Mr. Rashid had said, he basically mentioned that journalists were flogged during the Zia-ul-Haq regime, and basically during that time. And now, it wasn't like a total complete, you know, blanket ban on the media, but now it was kind of a blanket ban till, you know, some of the media organizations kind of agreed to sign the basically follow the toe the government line. So I just wanted your views on do you think it's better to have no information at all, or to have information which is basically filtered through the government, basically censored information?
Thank you.
Elizabeth Angel, I'm with OSI. I was wondering if you could talk a bit more about some of the creative methods that journalists in Pakistan are using now to try and get the news out, to try and dialogue with the public under the circumstances. I know, for example, that Talat Hussein has actually taken his talk show into the streets, and that people are using the internet in sort of inventive ways. And I wish if you could just give some examples and discuss how you see these things moving forward under the circumstances.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
Hi, my name is Elise Harris. I wanted to ask the panelists if they had any recommendations about actions Americans could take in terms of working with their government, interacting with their government on these issues. And the other question I had to do with, you know, yes, the government put pressure on Musharraf to step down as army chief. What kinds of movements do you think would be helpful in terms of keeping the pressure on the military that, no matter what, calls a lot of the shots, to have a more pro-democratic, pro-free media, pro-human rights regime in the future?
Okay, thank you. We have three questions, and we have a few minutes left. Should we start from Washington? Is it better to have a filtered press or none at all?
Maybe
not a fair question. But
Let me first correct the lady. During the during the time of General Zia-ul-Haq, there was no electronic media, and he was dealing only with the print press at that time. But the type of censorship we had in protest, there were certain newspapers, and they were publishing the blank papers because the censor officer would ask editor not to publish those stories, and sometimes they would ask not to publish the pages, the full pages. So newspaper would appear with 10 pages, and perhaps matter only on 2 pages, and 8 pages were blank. So there was a worse type of censorship at that time too. Now coming to the filtered information, purpose of media is to analyze and report objectively. This is their responsibility. Once you filter the information, then you don't have any objectivity. And I don't think that information is going to, half information, half truths are always harmful rather than becoming beneficiary. So the idea of filtered information, I don't think so it's going to work out in the civilized world. And on the other point, that what Americans can do, Americans have done a lot. Nobody at this moment wants any instability in Pakistan. That's why everybody is trying to work out a smooth transfer of power. And as I mentioned earlier, Washington did put pressure on Islamabad, and there is room for more pressure. And if the pressure continues, as President Musharraf said, he's going to lift emergency on 16th of December, then comes the other issue that have an independent election commissioner. So I think the pressure is on. And if maybe it is not up to the expectations of few of us, but pressure is on, and if this pressure continues, I'm optimistic, and I think things will be better.
Thank you.
I think one of the questions was about how people here can take action to help the situation, and I think we've already established the fact that without a free press, you really can't give people information in order to have really free and fair elections. I would say, as cliche as it sounds, write your congressman. Senator Joe Biden has really taken a stand on this issue. He was in part galvanized by the deluge of email he received. There are other lawmakers who are involved can you think of any? I can't think of anyone. There were 38 who signed the letter. And you can look that up online and write them, or just write your own representative and let them know that you care about this issue and the inherent hypocrisy in the United States, at the very least being complicit in what's happening over there, and that this is not just about free and fair elections, this tagline that everybody is running with. The fact of the matter is that the media is still censored, and as long as that continues, these free and fair elections are just lip service.
Bob, can you talk a little bit also about, in answering the question, about what can be done, what journalists around the world are doing in their various organizations, as well as here?
Frankly, Pakistan is in the crosshairs of every journalist support organization in the world right now. Pakistani journalists have been quite good at establishing the global network. They're well supported here. I think among journalists covering the story in Pakistan, Western journalists included, I think they do have a good understanding. I think they empathize very very closely with their Pakistani colleagues. I write to Biden, yes. Write to newspapers. Express your concern. In the end, I think this is going to actually back to this very fundamental question of how the United States relates to Pakistan. I think it would be decided on issues above our concern for open media or free and fair elections or a more democratic Pakistan. I think the decisions would be made on other lines here. But I think you can bring that pressure, and I think you can bring it through your elected representatives. I just want to close on one thing. After November 3rd, in the days following November 3rd, and Sammy knows this, we keep a very wide network going with Pakistani journalists around the country, and everywhere. And I got 8 messages or variations on the same message of, if something happens to me, call these numbers. These 8 journalists. They are still waiting to be picked up. They don't trust Musharraf. They don't trust this situation. 2 days ago, November 29th, the government brought what's called a first FIR. Yeah, against the Pakistan Federal Union of Journalists. Basically, the first time one. It's a warrant. It's under this old British system. It's a warrant in which people can be arrested with. Without a warrant.
It's a warrantless arrest.
Warrantless arrest, thanks. That's hanging over the head of every Pakistani journalist right now. It's the first time, it didn't name specific Pakistani journalists, the first time an FIR has ever been brought in Pakistan. What it did was name the Pakistan Federal Union of Journalists and the Rawalpindi Islamabad Union of Journalists. Those guys and women are out there pretty much still worried, still frightened. They just don't know what's coming. I don't know anyone who expects something good to happen in the next 2 months, 6 months in Pakistan. And the people people I think are fearing it the most are the journalists. And one other point.
Sir, can I add something to what you said?
No, come on now. Please.
You're talking about a country where the Chief Justice was looking for...
Come on, protest. Can we have a little respect for the speaker? Thank you.
The other thing is, I know you have a question. The other thing is that... if you've looked at the history of Pakistan, looked at what's happened to journalism in Pakistan. I think at this point you have to accept that journalism, the institution of journalism, has become the repository of democratic ideals in Pakistan. The judiciary has failed at times, the legislature certainly has, and the executive branch has failed. And one of the only institutions that still operates in Pakistan is journalism, and it's driven by journalists who have a very clear commitment and a very clear understanding of what their role is in society. And so many of these men and women are still pursuing that role, and with a degree of equipment, commitment, and at such a high degree of risk that I think you have to basically put your faith in Pakistani journalists and not much else in Pakistan.
We have one more question. I'd like to take the question, but then we have to wrap up.
It's a short one, very short.
Just your name and your question. You're welcome.
Tahira Naqvi. I teach at NYU, and this is for Sami Sahab. I have to use this opportunity to thank you, thank Gio, and commend Gio for an amazing job. I was looking this whole time to find somebody that I could go up to and say thank you, Gio. And I'm so glad I can do it now. Otherwise, I would be a very frustrated person. Gio did so much for me. I started watching it religiously from the day the emergency was declared. I get home around 5 and I would watch it until 11. And I was there when Dr. Masood Shahid signed off in tears along with the young woman. And I was also weeping at that time. What I wanted to ask you is, now that the talk shows are back on again, is Hamid Mir and Kamran Khan and Dr. Masood back on again as well?
Well, the talk shows will be on from next week, because what happened when the Dubai government canceled our license to operate as a Geo News in Dubai, then all the technical staffs were sent back from Dubai to Pakistan. And the other thing which happened, with those shows we were producing in Pakistan, we had a lot of technical problems in transmitting those shows to Dubai. But we have a contingency plan, we are working on it, and the Geo management has announced that from next week, you will be able to watch all the shows, Kamran Khan, Dr. Shahid Masood, right. Hamid Mir, Jawab Dish, everything will be back on air from next week. And taking this opportunity, I would say that the power of the Geo is all the audience and the viewers and the love and affection, emails, messages, what we received during that time was really, really very encouraging. And we must also thank here Bob D.D. sitting. Dubai government lifted the ban, and it would not have been possible if the international organizations like CPJ and Human Rights Watch and International Federation of Journalists, if they had not written to the Dubai government and they had not put any pressure. So this pressure is very important. And again, Anthony, I mean, talking about Pakistan and gathering people in New York, it is really a great service, and we really, really thankful, and we expect more, and this will really help people in Pakistan, especially to liberate the media from the clutches of the army, I would say.
I think this is a very good note on which to end, with two messages of action and vigilance, and also a little bit of hope. I really want to thank my colleagues Fawzia Naqvi and Robert Vandinas, who put the event together. And I'd like very much to thank all of our speakers for their commitment and their clarity in explaining to us the current situation. So would all of you join me and thank our speakers and filmmaker.